This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Talking the talk with head tongue to toe. Walking the walk. Education can be so awkward. Spotlight. On Academics We Know.
Kia ora, haere mai, and welcome to Spotlights on Academics We Know, the podcast. I'm your host, Adrian Buckingham, in Otapoti, Dunedin. Join me for conversations with lecturers, researchers, and practitioners about contemporary challenges, ideas, and potential opportunities for education and upskilling. Learning can be awkward. We aim to normalize the discomfort of being at the edge of new knowledge. This is so awkward. Dr. Steph Ravel is a principal lecturer at Otago Polytechnic Te Pukenga in the College of Community Development and Personal Wellbeing. She is the head of Human and Community Services. She's a counselor and supervisor and passionate about outdoor therapy. Her PhD focused on the use of walk and talk as a therapeutic activity. Steph is happiest on her bike. Kia ora, Steph. Nice to see you.
Kia ora, Adrian. Thanks for inviting me along.
Well, let's start this conversation by sharing with the audience a little bit about who you are.
Wonderful. Thank you. I'd like to start with me, first of all. So, kia ora, ko Taranaki te Turaka Waiwai. E tipu aki au ki ngā motu. E raro e te maru o te mauka o Taranaki. I te taha o te awa o Waiwaka iho, kei te noho au ki o te poti. Ko Ingarangi Rawa, ko Irish ka iwi, ko Steph Revel, toku ikua. Tēnā koutou katoa.
Oh, kia ora. Thank you so much, Steph. So tell me a little bit about how you found yourself down in Dunedin from Taranaki.
Well, probably a very circuitous route. So after growing up in Taranaki, I moved to Palmerston North, and that's where I did my first undergraduate degree at Massey University.
And what were you studying?
I studied social sciences and majored in psychology, and did a few sociology papers, but really through that found that psychology was where my interest and where my understanding lay.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it, the understanding, because sociology I find interesting, but I also, you know, I can remember being able to walk through assessments for psychology and really finding sociology hard and a bit of a grind. It's just a way of thinking, isn't it?
Absolutely. And interestingly, for me at that time, my dad, who worked in an accountancy area, and he decided to go back to or to go into tertiary study, and so him and I ended up doing our degrees at the same time.
Wow.
And he was really passionate and very good at understanding sociology, so we had lots of conversations where I was having to say to him, can you just run that by me again? Can you explain this to me in ways that I can understand it? So, yeah.
Were you in classes together?
We were.
Did you sit together or did you avoid him?
Oh, do you know, sometimes I did sit with him. Other times I had friends who'd say, oh, we saw your dad in class today and we had a chat to him. So it was really fun. I mean, my brother, prior to starting uni, my brother used to wind me up by saying, oh, you've all got to sit in alphabetical order, so you'll end up sitting next to Dad.
Yeah.
You know, and of course I didn't know any different and I was horrified at the thought. But then, you know, the reality, it turned out to be a really wonderful experience to share with him.
And experience.
He would take lecture notes for me and and there was no judgment if I didn't turn up to lectures. So.
Hey, that's quite useful. That's a pretty cool dad you've got there.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're in Palmerston North. You finish your degree in psychology.
Yeah.
What happens next?
And then I moved to Nelson for a while and did something totally different. Worked in cafes and on a apple orchard. I discovered that actually I wasn't very good at picking apples.
Okay.
So
Not a skill set.
And then that was when started thinking broader, beyond New Zealand horizons, and moved over to, or went travelling, Southeast East Asia, and with the idea of ending up in the UK. My grandmother was born in Reading, so had an ancestral visa, I think they were called at that time.
Yes.
And so that gave me up to 4 years, and that was the plan, that after 4 years I'd return to Aotearoa and decide what next. However, as with most long-term plans, they generally don't go
to plan.
To plan, that's right. So in my third year, I ended up meeting a wonderful Scottish man, and we've got now a couple of daughters who were born in England, and it took 18 years to come back home.
That is a slow route home. And you came back with a little bit more education under your belt, didn't you?
Ah, that's right, yes. So I'd always been really intrigued and fascinated by the idea of adventure therapy. And when I was in Palmerston North, I did some volunteer work for a youth organisation, and we used to take these young people away on camps during the school holidays in this to the central North Island. And they were outdoor camps, so you'd get to do loads of fun things, you know, kayaking, gorge walking, hill walking, you know. And it was often said at that time that the relationships that you could develop during those 1 week experiences and the bonds you would make and the growth that these young people would have would be worth, you know, it would take more than 6 months in the community to have that same, you know, that was what was supposed, you know, and what was suggested.
So the idea that the challenges of nature sort of help build resilience, that you've got that shared experience that builds relationship. What works about adventure therapy?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Probably not one that I'm going to hazard a guess at. But, you know, it's probably all those things you've mentioned. And just the opportunity, I think what struck me was for young people to experience themselves being in the world in totally different ways. So they weren't, so they were encountering different registers for what was success and what was not success, and having the opportunity to just, I guess, be themselves and have new experiences, really.
And these young people that you were working with, did most of them have experience in the outdoors before this program, or was it new?
Yeah. From what I can remember, it was generally, you know, new. New experiences.
So you clearly enjoyed being outdoors yourself.
Yes.
And then enjoyed watching these young people sort of change the way they look at themselves and their own successes. So how does that lead into more study?
That's right. So I did various jobs when I first got to the UK, and soon came to realise that if I wanted to work with people in you know, sort of deeper, more intentional ways, that I needed to further education. So I did postgrad diploma in development training. And so that would be probably in a New Zealand context, would be around, you know, sort of outdoor group facilitation in both corporate and youth contexts.
And did you have experience with both youth and corporate participants?
Yes.
And what's the difference between working with youth and working with corporates?
Ah, that's a great question. Probably fundamentally not much different.
Okay, excellent. But in terms we're all just people.
Yeah, that's right. But maybe with corporate, you know, it's more geared towards teamwork, you know, communication. But again, you know, that also fits for young people as well. So. Yeah.
So you just start working in that area with your postgraduate?
That's right. Yeah. And then it became clearer to me that actually doing some form of therapy training was going to be necessary. So I embarked on counselling training, and that was wonderful. That led on to a master's, and eventually leading on to PhD.
Wow, you've been busy.
Mm.
So did you practice for long with counseling once you had the qualification?
Not very long. Mm-hmm. So around towards the end of my counselling training, I became pregnant. Mm-hmm. So I had a break in practice while I had my two wonderful daughters.
Yeah, divided priorities.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So, you know, I worked part-time. I mm-hmm. worked in some wonderful contexts, not mm-hmm. outdoor-based, and mm-hmm. Worked at a university in a student health service for a couple of years, and that was great. And I think that also really made me realise just how much I loved being in a learning environment.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's clearly something about that larger learning environment, because that's where you are now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the role you do now?
Ah, okay. So I've got multiple hats in the role that I have at the moment. So in my teaching role, I am the lecturer in the Year 2 counselling specialty. So this is the first year in the Bachelors of Social Services, which I teach on, where so in Year 2, the students start working in the specialty, studying in the specialty. And then I'm also currently head of programs for the Human and Community Services area. So that incorporates the Bachelor of Social Services, Diploma in Youth Work, and Certificate in Health and Wellbeing.
Fantastic. So your week is quite varied, it sounds like, between students and staff and organizational projects.
That's right.
What do you like about your current role?
Oh, well, the variety. I think I really enjoy being able to utilize different skills in different spaces. I love working with our students and seeing their growth and development, and having just, you know, no class conversation is the same. So, you know, I learn as much from how they're responding to the material as as much as I hope they're learning from their readings and the class exercises. So, yeah. And I also love, you know, working along the staff teams that we have in this area, wonderful group of staff of which you are a member.
Oh, thank you. I'll take that compliment.
Yeah. And it's just great, you know, to be able to work in such a,
And the team that you work alongside is actually a really varied team in terms of knowledge and experience. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So people do come from diverse backgrounds, you know, professional backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And I think the one thing that consistently strikes me is just how generous people are with sharing their knowledge and supporting each other, and the passion that they have for their particular industries. So having people who might have come from a teaching background or have interests in, you know, the wellbeing space or, you know, other backgrounds like counselling, social work, you know, it's just so diverse.
And it's quite a different skill set. Is it quite a different lens that people bring to the table with their priorities, or are human services tied with some similar themes?
I probably think it's a bit of both. And I think that's what makes it so rich, is that there is the space to bring your own lens if there's something that you have a particular skill set in or a particular passion, and to integrate that into the programs, while at the same time moving towards, you know, if you want to say a common goal or a common area. So I just think it's great.
Yeah, I'm so impressed that we have so many students that are enrolled because they are just passionate about other people and wanting to contribute to the space and change how we operate for the better in health and well-being and how we support the people in our community. I really like that. I find myself really motivated by that. What do you like about learning? Because you're in the learning environment, and there's lots of different ways you can be learning. So tell me, what are your favorite aspects?
So this might sound a bit strange, but I really love the challenge element that I believe exists in learning spaces or that can be useful.
What about the challenge?
Mm.
Yeah.
So I think that the challenge can come in various ways. It can come when we might hit up against or get to the edge of, you know, some of our thinking. So it's that challenge to be flexible and open to hearing new ways of doing things, or to learning new ideas, new theories, how that might be applied in practice. I also think the challenge can sit, you know, sort of in a personal way. So that self-development that happens when you're engaged in that learning process, whether it's intentional or not, I think it has the potential for transformation and can really go on to change lives.
Yeah, wow. Well, I guess inherent in the idea of challenge is the idea that you can overcome it or that you conquer it of some sort. Mm. Is that part of your idea for challenge? Are you goal-focused?
Probably more process-focused.
Okay.
So maybe it's more about, you know, how myself, how others approach the challenge and work with it. I see it as that process of learning and discovery and what's needed in that setting in order for that challenge to be useful and not a barrier to learning. You know, I don't think learning environments or learning contexts need to be smooth. I don't believe they need to be without challenge or without disruption or without some nitty-gritty in there.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably a really realistic way to look at things, especially on the back of the last 3 years. You've probably been watching your colleagues but also your students learning in really new, challenging ways. Do you think that what do you think we're gaining from knuckling down and dealing with the nitty-gritty?
I wonder if it's about developing that capacity to be agile in the face of so much that's unknown and in the face of change. You know, I think if there's one thing that, as you say, the events of the last 3 years have taught us is that, you know, there's unpredictability in the world. And I imagine that that's not going to go away anytime soon.
No.
You know, and maybe it challenged people's sense of security or sense of the known.
There was maybe a false sense of security and maybe a false sense of the known. I think one of my favorite quotes is from my mom, and it's control is an illusion. I've got a friend of mine who's changed that. She's like, well, after the 3 years, you know, it's not an illusion to think you're in control. It's absolutely delusional. Like, there's just no way anybody can be controlling where we're going and how things are happening. So we've talked about learning being uncomfortable. Tell me about an awkward learning moment that you've had.
Oh, that's a great question. So one that springs to mind actually is I was doing many years ago. I was on a climb with a friend, and I was being taught the art of multi-pitch climbing, and I had or Actually, should I say it was lead climbing. So what that means is that's the first person who goes up and you clip in to, on this particular route, you clip into bolts.
Right.
And then the person that you're climbing with follows up after you. So lead climbing was something that really terrified me and stretched me. I much preferred to be the second person coming up with the security of the rope.
I can imagine.
Yeah, held very tightly by the belayer. So on this particular climb, I got into a spot of difficulty at some point, and the person who I was climbing with was attempting to talk me through a new the use of a new piece of equipment that I hadn't used before in the moment while I was pretty gripped.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was your brain really ready to learn something new?
Yeah, it wasn't. Funnily enough.
You freaked out.
That's right. So that was really awkward because I had to, you know, it was a challenge for me, and I'm not suggesting that all learning situations need to include such a high level of physical and emotional challenge. But it was a challenge, and it was really awkward because I, you know, was faced with the limit of my knowledge in that particular moment, and I had to work through that in order to get to the top.
Okay.
You know, there was no alternative.
Yeah.
So
forced to push through.
Mm.
That doesn't just sound uncomfortable. That sounds scary.
Mm.
Just because you're actually in physical danger when you're doing that, aren't you? Or not?
Not, you know, there was a high level of perceived physical danger.
Okay.
But it wasn't, you know, I wasn't at any point in danger of, you know, tumbling to my demise or anything like that.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you really take on challenges of learning in your personal life and in terms of your hobbies and that sort of thing. And then, of course, in the classroom or in the lecture theater. I guess the other place you'd be doing a lot of learning is research. So can you tell me a little bit about how research has shaped your career?
Yeah. So I would say that this has been an accidental pathway that I've stumbled on. I sometimes describe myself. Yeah, that's right. I do sometimes describe myself as an accidental academic. So school learning was not ever something that I was particularly good at. I went to school for the social element and, you know, sort of just got by.
I believe that because you're very likable and you chat a lot and then you studied psychology. So that all fits together for me and my understanding.
Great.
Sorry. Keep going.
Yeah.
So for lunch.
Yeah. So it was at the end of my counselling training where I was very fortunate to have a couple of encounters with some professors in the counselling and psychotherapy world. And it was through those conversations that my curiosity really started to get activated in terms of outdoor therapy. So, you know, there are these two worlds that at that time seemed to be developing, a voice and a research base of, you know, we have a hunch that, you know, the outdoor world and therapy could come together in some useful and meaningful way for the client groups that it serves. Mm-hmm. But I think it was slowly developing a presence.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's like just a moment in time, really, when two ideas come colliding together, and that was the perfect time for you to be there?
That's right.
Yeah.
And there was also the sense that somehow I might be capable of contributing or at least investigating an area that could be of use.
Well, you clearly had a foot in both worlds, so to make sense of it by bringing them together, that's a pretty exciting proposition for someone at any age.
Yeah.
How old were you when this sort of dawned on you?
Probably late 20s, I would say. Yeah.
Okay. Just coming out of adolescence.
That's
in theory.
Right.
Yeah. So tell me about the research that you embarked on.
So first of all, I decided to cast a really wide net and looked at outdoor therapy and in particular, what was it about outdoor therapy experiences that participants found helpful and unhelpful. And I'm always a great supporter of giving as much weight to the unhelpful elements as, you know, as well as finding out in what ways can it benefit, because I think there's so much that can be learned from finding out, you know, in what ways did this not fit for somebody.
And I'm sure it can be tempting for a lot of researchers to ignore what didn't work and just talk about what did work. So I think it's really brave to give your full attention and do a 360 of what's happening. Mm. So what did your research find? Who did you research? Who was included in this and what did you learn?
Yeah. So I decided to do an online study. Mm-hmm. So, and it was just a questionnaire. So when I say just, so I guess what I'm trying to say is that the results were limited in terms of the depth.
Okay.
But what it showed was that for those people who had engaged or experienced outdoor therapy experiences, and I would say too that that term is really broad, and mm-hmm. that raised, you know, one of the limitations of the research, that, you know, what one person was describing as outdoor therapy, perhaps for somebody else, they might not have thought it was outdoor therapy.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so that again raised a curiosity of, oh, how are we defining, you know, this field and what practice sits within that? So, so it was an international study, and what people reported was that, you know, it was really the outdoor environment that made the difference.
That's the bit that mattered.
Yeah,
so that's the bit that mattered.
Where they were. And then it was their relationships with other group participants, if it was a group setting. And then third, I think, on the list was therapists, their relationship with therapists.
Okay. So, as therapists, we're maybe not as useful as we think.
Well, maybe there's certain contexts in which, you know, relationships are developed with human and non-human aspects.
No, that sounds fantastic. So what kinds of activities did you include as being therapeutic experiences in the outdoors? Mm. So are we talking walking up hills or flying a kite? What are we doing?
Yeah, I tried to define it to make sure that really those who were responding were sort of in a general ballpark. So it didn't include, you know, what's known as therapeutic recreation, for example. So, you know, flying a kite, walking uphill can be seen to be broadly therapeutic and supportive of well-being.
Yes.
However, it's not intentional therapy.
Okay.
Yeah. So I tried to keep it broad but also focused in some way.
Fantastic. Mm. And have you been interested in doing much research since your PhD?
Absolutely. So that, you know, doing my master's, and I had a fabulous supervisor who was really encouraging and interested in outdoor therapy. And, you know, so I think it can be said of a lot of research that you can end up with more questions at the end of a process than what you might have at the beginning, because then you have a sense of, or more of a sense of what you don't know.
Yeah, the more you know, the less you know.
That's exactly right. So, you know, that really sparked a lot of curiosity and really helped me refine a direction of research that I developed. And so I looked into walk and talk therapy as a therapeutic activity.
Walk and talk.
Walk and talk.
And it is what it says.
It is what it says. And I didn't come up with the term. It was a term, I think, that originated in the States and North America.
It sounds really appealing. The idea of sitting across from somebody and talking can be really intimidating. So I guess there's that environmental bit where you're outside and in a different space, but also just not staring at a person across a space is probably helpful for a lot of people.
Yeah, and it seems to be. And it's interesting that one of the things that came from the research, so I did multiple studies, which was great because it meant that I wasn't just having to settle on one question and find an answer to that one thing.
Yeah.
And it seemed that for everything that was a benefit or that people identified as being helpful, it also had limitations. So for some people, in one of my studies, I explored potential clients' perceptions. So this is where a group of large group of university students came in really handy. And for some people, the idea of walk and talk, they actually felt a bit, you know, not that sold on because they said, how will I know if my therapist is looking at me? If I can't see where their eye gaze is, if I can't see their facial expressions.
Are they listening?
Are they listening? You know, what if they start to wander off or see a dog and think, oh, I'm going to go and pet the dog? So, you know, that to them, they imagined it wouldn't actually be a very helpful therapeutic activity. Whereas for others, as you say, they talked about, you know, if I had something that was really shaming to talk about or that I felt embarrassed about or a bit uncertain how it might be received, that actually maybe not seeing somebody's face and seeing their reaction could be helpful.
Great. Oh, that's such interesting research to have come across. Are you – what sort of field are you looking at now in terms of where your interest and curiosity lies? Is it – further down this path, or are you starting to introduce new ideas into what you're choosing to seek out and teach?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I hold a lot of curiosities around counsellor education, particularly at this moment in time with, you know, with the creation of Te Pūkenga and hearing about unification and wondering what might that mean for the pathway we offer. And wanting to really be intentional about any changes that get made and I guess examining, you know, what could be helpful and what could be unhelpful in that space. I'm also really curious about counsellor educators' experiences of working in this space. You know, it can be challenging, you know, and I think there's been limited research that's explored probably on both sides, you know, trainee experiences of embarking on such a program, you know, because it's not just about theoretical knowledge, gaining that. It's about how do you apply that in practice, but also too, where does that sit and how does that interact with your own self-awareness and personal development?
Absolutely. And do you think the change in the structure of the organization might change the individual student experience of that?
Potentially, depending on, you know, how the program might change.
Yeah, so it's a matter of wait and see, really,
isn't it? Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess probably wait and see is one of the answers to this question. But what sort of difficulties or widow or challenges are currently in your path?
I would say it's probably just the awareness to sit with the unknown, be aware of when the discomfort arises with that, but also to, you know, being kind to myself and wanting to support the staff that work in all of these programs. You know, we're all trying to make sense of what we know and what we don't know about the changes that are coming. And you know, it's like keeping some sense of stability in the shifting sands, really.
Well, I think you're doing a great job of looking after the team that way. And even if, which way the tide's going isn't clear, who you're alongside and how we treat each other really matters. And,
absolutely.
So I really appreciate your leadership there, Steph.
Oh, that's kind. Thank you.
What are you looking forward to?
Well, the new possibilities that may emerge, I think that's really exciting, the new possibilities.
The new possibilities.
The new possibilities, yeah.
So anything you're looking forward to later this year in your life outside of work?
Yes, I'm going to – I do love cycling and I love going on cycling journeys. So again
– you went on quite a large cycling journey last year, didn't you?
Yeah, not probably large in the grand scheme of things. It was only a few days.
Well, but that sounds large to me, just saying.
Yeah. Yes, I cycled the Alps to Ocean Trail, and that was just wonderful.
Wow. Mm. And how far is that?
That's a good question. Oh. I think it's 300 and something kilometres.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot to me, but maybe not in the biking world.
Well, no. Okay. And didn't do it all at once, so that helps.
That helps. Okay, and what, in terms of cycling, are you doing this year and you're looking forward to?
Yeah, so I did that cycling journey last year with my cousin, and he's fabulous. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to spend time with whānau, and to do something adventurous and to have a lot of laugh along the way. So we're going to attempt to cycle from Queenstown to Dunedin. Again, not all in one go.
Wow, yep.
And we will need to get a shuttle at one point, and we've even got a jet boat transfer in the Roxburgh Gorge. It's
wow, you just
no
put
option.
Your bike on the Roxburgh Gorge jet.
That's right.
Oh wow.
Yeah, apparently it's a thing.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So that's really something tangible to look forward to. Oh, that's exciting. Well, we're at unrelated question session, so do you have any questions for me?
Yeah. What do you like to do in your outside of work time?
Oh, good question.
What lights your fire?
Well, I am dog sitting for a year, and I adopted, well, semi-adopted or fostering a Sprawly since December. And so we had about 6 months together. And I would say that almost all of my time outside of work and outside of parenting is taken up by walking that dog. and he's turned out to be great, I think, after I got quite sick with COVID. And after that, it was sort of a bit of a burden to have somebody else to look after. But he has just been brilliant. And we've had some crazy weather. And I find myself out at Second Beach with like howling winds and rain.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be doing that if he didn't exist. So that's quite good. And the other thing that I'm pretty excited about at the moment is that I've gone back to roller derby.
Oh, fabulous.
So it's a fantastic community of just really motivated, inclusive people. And I was involved years ago, and I'm now learning the new rules, and I'm trying to be a referee for that. So it's been really fun to get back on skates. That's been the most fun part of it. And that's how I'm spending my time outside of work.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds great. I'm very impressed at the idea of being on roller skates. It's something that I've probably not considered for myself over the age of 25.
Well, I think it's probably a bit like you on a bike. Uh-huh. Like it just, there's a little bit about a bit of a breeze going past your face and just have that little feeling of yee!
Yeah.
That goes,
the whoosh.
Yeah, exactly right. The whoosh that happens.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, you need those things. You need ways that you can be out in nature, and ways you get to be with a community and move your body and turn your brain onto something else entirely. And I think that's probably the healthiest way to be.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, well, thanks so much, Steph. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks very much, Adrian.
Ka mihi. Thank you for listening to Spotlight on Academics We Know. Thanks to Otago Polytechnic, our people make a better world. Kia tu ki te tahi. If you'd like to listen to this episode again, you'll find the podcast on Otago Access Radio's website, oar.org.nz. This has been So Ok. Ma te wa.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.